My name is Mark Schwain, and I did grow up in Hannibal, Missouri, which complicates matters. Mark Schwain from Hannibal. And this is my first time at Holden, and also I guess I should tell you this is the first session I've done here at Holden, so I feel a special kinship with those of you who are also here for your first time. I'll further give you some background about myself in terms of three warnings. The first is that I'm not a theologian. You should know this because during the course of my presentation, I'm going to be encroaching on that terrain a bit and perhaps skating over some rather thin ice. And I'm pleased to see and know that there are so many theologians here who can add support and correction and reproof and clarification where that is needful. The second thing is that I'm at home in the academy, that is, that's where I work, an academic. Academics have certain unfortunate tendencies. One is to make simple things obscure, and then to obscure simple things, and to be rather long-winded about it all in the process. And I'm afraid that I might fall prey to some of these tendencies. And should I be inclined in any of those directions, raise your hands to interrupt and ask what on earth I'm talking about, if you've lost track of where I'm going, and if I seem to be too long-winded and not letting us get to talk together, as is my major intention, let me know. The third warning has to do with where I live here at the village. I was astonished when I got off the bus. Walt Bowman was there to greet me. I'd never met Walt before. And after a word of greeting, he turned to me and my wife and our little girl, Keita, and said, I think I'm going to put you all in the hospital. And this puzzled me a great deal. At first I thought perhaps there'd been a kind of plague in Chelan, and then I began to wonder how I looked, how we looked. We have pox or something. Turns out that one of the apartments is located in the hospital, and that's where we're housed. What's even more arresting and humorous to me, I was in the hospital portion of the building and returning to my apartment and noticed this morning for the first time the sign above the door, which says tavern. So when you come into our apartment from the hospital side, you think you're entering a tavern, and when you come up to it from the front, you think you're going to a hospital, and that's where we live. So you're about ready to hear some ethical discourse from a person who's not a theologian, who lives in a tavern, and who was put into a hospital when he first arrived. So you've got to be suspicious on all of those grounds, I guess. The title of my presentation, as it's advertised on the bulletin board, is What is a Christian Action? It's a kind of question. And then a subtitle, The Church and Politics. A very vast, broad area to explore. Since this is an early presentation, as the week is put together, I think it's useful to try to use what I have to say and what we discuss afterwards as a kind of introduction to a lot that's going to be going on here during the week. I'm struck, when I look at the program, at the convergence of a lot of the separate sessions around, broadly, the relationship between being and doing. Or, to put it differently, the relationship of who we are as people, and what we do. Or, to put it still differently, the relationship between the spiritual life, on the one hand, and the ethical life, that is, action, on the other. As you know, John Schramm will be leading a group in the afternoons exploring a book with the very fascinating title, Politics of Jesus. This evening, the forum is on the question of whether or not and to what extent Christians or anyone else can affect the behavior of corporations. Jody Kretzmann will be doing some presentations on an agenda for urban life, things to do, where we've been, where we're going. So the emphasis on the one hand on action, and on the other hand the connection between action of various kinds, both individually and corporately, to the Christian life. Now this is by no means meant to commit all of these people whom I've mentioned, that I could include Vern as well, who's reading Isaiah under the rubric Poetry and Politics, to that kind of direct attack to the question of Christianity and action. But it is to suggest that, broadly speaking, we're going to concern ourselves together in all sorts of contexts and in terms of all sorts of subject matters with this relationship between being who we are and doing what we do. Therefore, what I'd like to do in the few minutes that follow is to lay out a kind of framework within which the question, what ought to be the relationship between what I do and who I am, can be answered and considered. Not to provide an answer, but to lay out a kind of framework within which the question can be asked. To provide a series of discriminations and distinctions which might prove useful to all of us during the week as we talk about these matters together. Being and doing. Incidentally, I don't endorse one of my favorite bits of graffiti. It's a kind of capsule summary of what are taken to be three distinct positions on the question of the relationship between being and doing. This piece of graffiti alleges that the three great philosophers who spoke to this question were Jean-Paul Sartre, John Stuart Mill, and Frank Sinatra. Allegedly, John Stuart Mill's position is supposed to have been to be is to do. Jean-Paul Sartre's position is supposed to have been to do is to be. And Frank Sinatra's position, doobie 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 doo. Let me then get to this framework. And here's what I want to do in what follows, a kind of outline. First, I want to lay out the framework in terms of a kind of history of reflection upon this issue of the relationship between being and doing, who we are and how we ought to act, both in terms of the history of philosophy, but also in intimate and immediate practical terms of how we think every day, the kinds of questions that occur to us, the kinds of things that we say when we try to appraise behavior, recommend certain kinds of behavior to certain of our fellow men. And once this framework is laid out, I then want to look at the Christian, and a little more specifically, the Lutheran position on these kinds of questions. And then finally, once I hope I've created some appreciation of the complexities of the situation, to suggest some implications for the framework on the question of an individual's relationship in terms of who he or she is to their behavior on the one hand, and then corporate kinds of questions. What is the group, the church's relationship to the polis, to the polity, to politics? So let me lay out the framework now. First, the word motive, then the word agent, then the word act, finally the word consequence. Virtually all persons who have occasion to reflect at all upon what the good life is, what the Christian life is, what good behavior, bad behavior is, whether they're ethical philosophers or persons like ourselves who make all kinds of appraisals and recommendations every day, tend to talk about all of these things, the reasons that people do things, motives, the people themselves who do the acting, the actions themselves, and the consequences that follow from those actions. But one way to get a quick feel for any position on these matters is to notice that anyone who talks about morality or ethics tends to emphasize, let me move this forward back a little bit, tends to emphasize one of these four elements in making ethical judgments or prescriptions. There are those of us, for example, for whom motive, the reasons people do what they do, is supremely important in thinking about behavior, action, ethics. And so we say, for example, someone hits someone over the head. Oh, she didn't really mean to do that, so don't take that all that seriously. Had she meant to do it, it would be a serious wrong, but she or he didn't really mean to do that. Or when we see President Carter tour the nuclear reactor in an effort to show a kind of sympathy or commitment to the safety of his fellow men and women there, some of us in cynical moments are inclined to say, well, the action itself may have been praiseworthy, but after all, he just is trying to get reelected. His motives are somehow suspect, and therefore his motives or his reasons in some way taint or compromise or determine the quality of his behavior. So we tend to talk this way all the time about motives, some of us. I suppose if one wanted to find a philosopher who represents this position, we would think of Immanuel Kant, the little hermit of Königsberg. I'll digress and tell you an anecdote about Kant, because I thought about Immanuel Kant this morning and how much he would have loved being at Holden, because Kant walked a great deal. In fact, people in Königsberg, when Immanuel Kant in the late 18th century used to walk around the village, used to literally set their watches by his walking, because he was very disciplined in taking these walks, kind of an early pioneer in aerobics. Why? Because Kant didn't write his three great books until he was 59 years old. Didn't start writing the three great books until he was that old. So there's hope for all of us yet. And he understood early that it was going to take him this long, wanted to stay healthy, and went on his long walks. It's quite true. A great, it seems to me, witness of courage and discipline. Kant also uttered what I take to be the most moving moral sentiment to come out of secular moral thinking, which reminded me a bit of some of the remarks in John's sermon last night, and also reminded me of some of the things Jody Kretzmann said in an earlier presentation. Kant said, in telling us how we ought to act, "Act so that you treat humanity, whether in your own person or in that of another, always as an end and never as a means only." Some have seen in this a kind of version of the golden rule, "Do unto others as you would have them do unto you." At any rate, Kant is a person who believes that motive, intention, reason is crucial in evaluating action and recommending certain kinds of actions to others. Next, we move on to agents. Some people say, well, it doesn't matter so much what exactly a person does, but who the person is if one wants to appraise ethical or moral questions. The question that concerns the ethical is the question of character, these people would argue. And so do we when we say to one another what a model that person is, what a great human being, a kind of witness to moral truth. And when we tend to find such a person, we tend to make all sorts of allowances when they do things that seem on the surface to be ethically problematic. We tend to wonder whether or not either they've made a mistake, a lapse that they didn't realize, or we tend to reconsider our own moral views because of the force of their witness and character. I was reminded this morning at Matins, one of the passages that was cited was, "Train up a child in the way he should go, and in his age he will not depart from it," of this ethical position. Because if we were to find a philosopher who represents this position, it would be Aristotle. Aristotle, who believed that ethics had fundamentally to do with habits or character formation, and that characters, personalities, were formed through training, through practice in doing the sorts of actions that, when they became habitual, formed good and virtuous characters. Let me see if I can speak about this more directly in terms of, well, here, yesterday, on the way back from my hike, I confronted the bear. I, as I told one of my friends, I'm getting to be a little paranoid. The bear was there, and it was rather startling to me to see a bear. I had never seen a bear. And I didn't run, and I'm happy to report. I stood and faced the bear, very firm, and then walked very deliberately away from the bear. Now, someone wants to appraise that action in terms of its virtue. Was it a virtuous thing to do? If they are act morality oriented, they would say, well, that was a virtuous action. Aristotle would say, no, if you're going to show courage, you do courageous things as the courageous man or woman would do them. Why did I stand firm and walk slowly away? Because I was terrified, paralyzed with fear. There was the bear, and I was caught unawares and froze. Okay? Now, the same person who is a courageous person and who can face bears with great determination would do the same thing, stand and walk slowly away without fleeing, but that person would show courage. I did not, even though we performed the same action. Okay? So you see the implications. Aristotle would say I was not showing courage. People who focus simply on actions would say that I did show courage because I did a courageous. Okay, I've already anticipated then the act-oriented ethics. The act-oriented ethics place a high premium upon objective content of actions, the what that we do, rather than the who that does the what. We would find examples of this in any heavily legal, prescriptive ethics. Thou shalt do this, thou shalt not do that. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Okay? Very direct statements of what we ought to do and what we ought not to do. And we're all, I think, more or less familiar with that kind of position. Finally, consequences. This is a tough one. Some people say it doesn't much matter what it is that you do at any one moment. What matters are the kinds of consequences that issue from that action. What are the long-term effects of doing X? We want to appraise the worthiness, the goodness, the value of a given action. We'd better attend not so much to what motivated it, not so much to who did it, but to what its results are. People like the utilitarians or John Dewey were very interested in the consequences of behavior. And I'll return to that problem later on in a little more detail. This then is the basic schema. If you want it, remember MAAC, we can call it the MAC schema, kind of an analysis of the different components that go into making ethical appraisals. Now what about, I haven't said anything about Christian action in this. Where do you suppose we would locate the center of gravity in terms of which four of these categories in the traditionally Protestant or more particularly the Lutheran view? Well, here I go skating out onto thin ice. My sense is that in our tradition we place an extraordinary emphasis on the agent, upon who. I wonder if that was a judgment. upon who we are. Who we are. Who it is we are. We are children of God. We are forgiven. We are simultaneously saints and sinners. We have a plus sign on us, on our value. Why? Because of what we do? No. Because of what God sees us as. Does God see us as people of his because of good performance? Because of performing certain actions? No, because of the merits and worthiness of Christ. So when God looks down, he imputes an ethical quality to us that he sees. And he sees it this way, not because of some kind of objective content in our performance, because we've been good today, yesterday, and forever, or tried to be good. No, no, no. It's because of Christ's sacrifice for us. So it seems to me that the Christian ethos, particularly the Lutheran ethos, has always presented an extraordinary emphasis upon the agent, who we are, and the notion that our identity is something that God sees in us because we are justified, and we all know this probably from memory, by grace through faith. Luther's position back through Augustine, reaching back to Paul, and Luther's discovery of the gospel in Romans and especially Galatians, is this position. Where are we left then about action? Because there would seem to be a very radical breach between who we are and what we do. Since what we do clearly doesn't determine who we are, it clearly doesn't have very much at all to do with who we are. This is a problem, and Lutheran ethicists, Christian ethicists, have noticed it and attacked it in a number of ways. Some have said, in terms of action, a Christian action, that what the gospel does is to liberate us, make us free to be obedient. Free to be obedient to what? Well, to the general guidelines of the Decalogue and or to the kinds of precepts that surface in Ephesians and other places about subordination and our place within the orders of creation. That's one kind of answer that you would get about how we act in our freedom in Christ. Another kind of answer you might get that I suspect from just reading the introductory chapter of Yoder's book is to take Christ as a kind of norm. Christ's person and Christ's action becomes a kind of norm for us to follow in our own behavior. It's another possible kind of answer to the question, how should we behave in Christian terms? Okay, now, but what happens in our congregations, and what happens in our face-to-face discourse with one another when issues such as this arise? We're at a voters' meeting, someone gets up and says, I think it's everyone's Christian duty here to favor nuclear disarmament unilaterally by the United States. It's clearly an unchristian thing to make weapons. This country is involved in weaponry. Therefore, either you as an individual, if you're to be Christian, must support through time and money nuclear disarmament, and or we as a corporate body, the church, ought to do what we can collectively to achieve this end. Or again, when people read the sign up there seeing what is a Christian action, people said, well, now why would anybody ask this question? We know what Christian action is. For one thing, help or serve the poor, relieve poverty, feed the poor. There's a Christian action. Who can doubt this? Okay. What are some problems with that as that arises and surfaces and someone makes that claim in our congregational meeting or in conversation? Well, here is where the relationship between actions of particular kinds and consequences surfaces. So I was going to return to that. Talked about the problem between agents and actions. Now I'm going to return to this. Christians seldom disagree fundamentally over ends. You seldom find someone stand up in a meeting or tell you privately, you know, I think we ought to do a little more to pollute the atmosphere. Or, I think we ought to give all of our money to General Motors. People aren't likely to recommend that kind of thing. People are likely to agree that the church ought to feed the poor, or that Christians ought to feed the poor. People are likely to disagree profoundly, however, over the best means to achieve these ends. That is, people tend to disagree not so much over ends, but over means. Over what Aristotle called prudential judgments. What will best relieve the plight of the poor? What will best feed them? Some people would say what's best always fed them, industrial capitalism. Create tremendous abundance, lots of jobs, the poor people will eventually benefit from this. That's the way to solve the problem of the church, is to become involved. Support industrial capitalism. Work hard. Create the virtues that make shrewd investment and solid business ventures. Others would say quite the opposite. Industrial capitalism is the problem, not the solution. We need a fundamental restructuring of the social order. Now notice that both of those people agree with the end, but they disagree about the relationship between particular actions and consequences. The capitalist assures us that shrewd business ventures and an expanding economy will best be the actions to serve the end of feeding the poor. The Marxist believes that some other solution altogether is required. And oftentimes those kinds of rhetorics get tangled with Christian rhetoric, and we're told that one or another of those means is somehow the only means to achieve the Christian end of feeding the poor. These, then, it seems to me, are some of the issues behind all of the particular debates over given ethical questions that we face as individuals, as Christians, as churches. I'll just close by making one final remark that I think is extremely important to make. And then we'll open it for discussion, and I'll ask for some help in clarifying these suggestions. Whatever we decide about the Christian view of where the center of gravity lies in estimating and recommending certain actions, supposing we decide it's with the agent after all, there's a radical separation between who we are and what we do, or supposing we decide that it is really what we do, and we can stand up and tell people what they must do if they're to be genuinely Christian. Whatever we decide about that matter as individuals, it's a separate question then to decide whether or not the corporate body of the church, as individual congregation, as whole synod, ought to, is required to, must engage in this, that, or the other set of actions in order to be somehow corporately ethical. In other words, those are two separate questions. They relate to one another, but just because you've solved the one, what must I do as a Christian? Is there such a particular thing, or is it rather who I am that determines my Christianity? However you decide that question, the question, what should the church do collectively, if it should do anything at all to solve social problems, is a different issue. Solving the one does not automatically solve the other. Okay, that I've tried to lay out a framework, a series of problems, a network of difficulties, and I invite all of you to jump in, but not all at once, to respond, make suggestions, questions. Yeah?
I'd like to respond to your polarizing the agent and the act and the problem that Christianity traditionally has with that. I'm not Lutheran, but I've been living in the Lutheran tradition for about 4 years, and so the whole Lutheran emphasis of grace and of God's action for us, maybe it seems a little more of an emphasis to me since I wasn't raised in that. I'm not so used to that just being there, well, of course, as a given. And so coming out of a different background, I really hear a difference and an emphasis on what God does determining who we are. And sometimes I hear it emphasized to the point where I think there really is a separation of being and doing. And there's kind of, well, we're sinners anyway, and we must live under grace. And as true as that is, the scripture is full of a different definition of faith, not as mere belief in what God has done for us, but belief that God loves and has acted on our behalf, and then to go further, that belief put in action by ourselves. And Paul is full of this in the New Testament, that we're known by the fruits of the Spirit. That marks us. James tells us that if there's no concrete love, there is no faith in Christ there, if you don't see it in the person's action. Gospel of John and 1 John. It says, if you don't act in love to your brother, you are in darkness, and you're not enlightened if you say you are.
Response to that? Amplification of it? She suggests that if we don't love our brother, we're in darkness, and that there is a particular, then, substantive, ethical content to the Christian life. I think that I didn't mean to suggest that at that level of love, freedom, justice, that Christians wouldn't all immediately concur that it's in the spirit of Christianity to be just, to love our brother, to be free in the gospel, and so on. I guess in order to sharpen the problem a little more, though, it seems to me that trouble, both in terms of our thinking about the matter and in terms of our day-by-day relationships with one another, with non-Christians, with the world at large, comes with at the point where we want to give those kinds of things specific content. What in this or that case does it mean to love the brother or sister? What in this particular instance does justice require? Okay, those are the tough questions, it seems to me. I do think we could all agree, and I think that the lack of anyone amplifying your remarks just shows the deep consensus that you've touched in what you've said here.
Yes. When you first asked the question of what is the Lutheran tradition, and having grown up in the Lutheran Church, I would have given a different answer. I followed your argument and think there's merit in it, but just let me reveal what I thought about when you first asked that question. And I would have put the emphasis then on motive, because of what Christ has done for me, saved me. Thus, I love. It is clearly not on the act, but is the motive that leads to the act.
Okay, it's because God first loved us that we are thereby enabled to love the brother and sister.
Yes.
That love being made concrete.
We have the opportunity and the demand to love both.
Responses to that? Yeah.
Well, I can understand where she's at, because I grew up in a very legalistic tradition, and I've only been Lutheran for more years than she's been around Lutherans. But what I find trouble still grappling with is what I call the big paradox, that even though we have been saved and we are able to love, we're unable to love, because we're still caught with one foot in the quicksand of original sin, and will be until this life is over. We still have this tugging in two directions, and even though we do know that yes, we should help feed the poor, and yes, we should do this and we should do that, our heart may say one thing, but the part, the old Adam, isn't that what they call it? Yeah, right. It's still tugging in the other direction. And so even though James says, yes, you must show your faith through works, we haven't yet arrived there to where we can always do this, because we're not perfect.
In Matthew, when in the Sermon on the Mount, when Christ says you must be perfect as your Heavenly Father is perfect, when I read that, I've almost thought, well, good grief, I know I can't do that. So God is telling me here that I must depend on His grace. And it almost has encouraged me at times to be apathetic in my actions. That I realize that you can't really do it, but just keep trying. And hopefully God will enable you to respond in more and more love. Well, in the original language, what that word means is not perfect as in all the time, 100%, but it means unconditionally. Love unconditionally. And that puts a whole different emphasis on everything. And I think sometimes when it comes to doing ethics, we get so caught up in how often can we do the optimally ethical thing, that we almost excuse ourselves from the ethical process.
Response to that? Okay, let me see if I can dramatize by role-playing here a bit of what's at stake, kind of sharpen the issue a bit. We all agree that we are who we are by virtue of God's grace. We all agree, furthermore, that living in a grace creation means loving our brother. I, however, believe that the way to achieve one of the great goals for mankind, peace, in this world, is to build armaments like mad. I'm for bigger defense spending. I think, in love for my brother, I want to ensure world stability. People suffer tremendously in war. Weapons basically deter countries from fighting one another. And if we let the Soviet Union get ahead, disaster will follow. They'll move someplace, we'll have to send an army over there, horrible deaths, destruction, obliteration. Therefore, if we really want to love our brother, we've got to get out there and do more for American national defense. Oppose the SALT Treaty, build new missile systems, spend more money. This is to act in love. In fact, this is a Christian action.
Sorry.
But my argument is that the consequences will be world peace forevermore. Why? Because everybody would be so terrified to use these weapons that nobody will. It will be unthinkable.
What kind of peace is that?
Well, it means that no one gets shot, no armies are fighting on the ground, everybody lives under a kind of...
Paranoia.
But that's better. That's better, since we live in a fallen world, than having massive land armies combating one another and thousands of human beings killed, uprooted, land devastated, so on and so forth.
But just because you say that's the consequence that will follow does not necessarily mean that is so. So therefore, we have to go back and look through history and see what it has meant in the past to stockpile arms and to put our faith in weapons rather than to put our faith in God who will guide us and protect us.
Your notion is that the lessons we learned from history would tend to suggest that my notion of a connection between action, building bigger missile silos, and consequences is simply either uninformed or wrong or both, right? And then we'll really get more bloodshed, which I guess was kind of your point.
But she's leaving the alternative that we would trust in God otherwise, and I don't think that alternative is there. Our country's not going to trust in God or build armaments. Those aren't the two poles, are they?
Anyone else?
You're down the crosshairs or the swords. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that kind of spending of money deprives. It's the external or somewhere out here possibility where your economic scope, or you ignore the today, the consequence of it also. It's sort of ignoring that.
So you're suggesting I've been blind to the fact that taking a dollar to build a missile is taking a dollar away from feeding hungry people, and that this is a grotesque sense of priority. Other responses? Yes?
I happen to know a person that believes very strongly the role you've just played. And he is a student of military history, all of this. I do not happen to agree with him, but he is very sincere in his position. Now, can I make the judgment that he is not a Christian?
That's good. That's a very excellent question. Any answer for his question?
I don't think you can.
No.
Well, can he make the judgment that I'm not because I don't agree with him?
No.
Well, then how can you have a Christian politics?
Is there a Christian action?
My Christian action right now is I pray for peace, but I pay for weapons through my taxes. I'm doing both. My actions are saying.
Well, you're missing the other point. You're expressing yourself for my help. Mm-hmm.
Can you speak up? We got too many people talking at once. Just let's do it one at a time so we can hear each other. Can you speak up?
If you pay taxes, this is not a voluntary act. I mean, you're sort of coerced into that, whether you want to or not. Yeah.
I can choose not to pay.
So, you could protest that.
There's a consequence for that.
Yes, better stay than what you mean. Hmm?
Let's come back to the question this gentleman asked over here about his friend. Everybody unanimously said, your question was, can I say then that my friend is not a Christian? Everybody over here immediately said, no, you can't say that. To which you then said, well then...
Can he assume that I'm not a Christian?
To which everybody said, no. To which I then said, well then is there a Christian action? Which is the whole title of this. Yes.
There's an action, but when you start putting labels on people and saying that's a Christian, you're being judgmental. And I don't think that necessarily is our right, okay? You got a conglomerate, you got different people, and if you tried to ask everybody here what it meant to be Lutheran, I think you'd have a different answer from everybody here. You would have a lot of points that would agree, but there would be a lot of, you know, different categories. It would go in all different kinds of directions. And what is a Christian action goes to what you were saying before. It comes from within you, your response to what you have felt called to do. That's what I just heard from the guy before you in here. And for me to start saying your action is right and or my action is right and yours is wrong, that's being judgmental. And I don't think even looking at Christ, he was ever that way. He never said do this or do that. He forgave. You know, you may do your action and I might not agree with it, and it might fall apart. It's not my point to say, hey, you're wrong. See, I told you so. Forgive. Or I may have been wrong, and hopefully I can be forgiven if I make it the previous me.
I think Christ was judgmental. He called people hypocrites, and he looked at the Pharisees and said, "No, you're not right."
You never said you're not right.
I believe that he didn't agree with their actions.
Okay, but take the prostitute, okay? Judging. Everybody there says, oh, that's wrong. You know, it's wrong to be a prostitute. It's wrong to sell your body in that way. And they brought her to Christ and asked him, well, what should you do? What should we do with her? And he looked around and he said, who has no sin, cast the first stone. And then he didn't even say you're wrong. He said, go and sin no more. But he didn't say, I condemn you. I tell you, you're a terrible person for that. And when you start saying to somebody, because you do that, you're totally wrong, that's a condemning thing. And I don't think Christ ever condemned the Pharisees either. Trying to stretch their mind.
Condemn the action, not the person.
Okay, but that opens the door again to condemning certain actions as being un-Christian actions, which a little bit before people kind of were wanting to deny or wonder about those or out.
It seems to me what we have happening oftentimes in Scripture is particularly with Christ's concern, is him taking a position that seems to be against the majority view, asks them to rethink. Perhaps if Christ were here now, the Pharisees would be the ones that would be getting the better shape, and the prostitutes would, because of the world, the situation changed in our world. I guess what I'm trying to say, maybe the whole point is that for every issue, there has to be some struggle and some balance, and perhaps there are those issues where the Christian community can agree, yes, this is a Christian ethic in this circumstance, generally. already And then we, you know, then I guess the horrifying term the church struggle with is situation ethics, which is, we've really been afraid of that one.
It's tough.
I think the point is that we need to struggle with it, that we're not going to get all these clean and neat categories. And we have tended to rather neatly place the Pharisees in that bad guy category and possibly in the good guy category as far as Christ is concerned. I'm not sure that would be the case anymore, if that was really the intent.
Well, we certainly wouldn't anymore place the prostitute in the good guy category. Yes. I was just kidding, Alan. The prostitute being a good guy.
Could I be so arrogant to put an alternative framework on the board that's very much in line with yours?
Well, of course.
I'm a social scientist, an economist, I'm sorry. I also grew up in a Norwegian ghetto in central Iowa.
But it's very much in line with your process, I think. The political question often is, what ought to be? Well, the answer to that, and I think that's what we're struggling with here, in terms of what ought to be, in this case, Christian action. I'm also left-handed and don't write very well. Now, it seems to me, well, it isn't original with me, a guy that told me this, but I've used it, it makes sense. The answer to the question, what ought to be, has two prior questions that need to be answered. One is, what is good? Or bad? And the other question is, what is, will be, could be, consequences? Now, people can disagree about the answer to the question, what ought to be, because they disagree about the reality side of it, or the non-normative side of it. What is, what will be, what could be, the consequences. They can also disagree about what is good and bad. And some of my friends tend to answer questions deciding what is good, and that's what ought to be. Other of my friends go down this side. And it seems to me you have to deal with both sides. And that one of the things that it seems to me that the Christian perspective is to clarify the debate on values of what is good and bad. There is the armament issue. There is a certain lifestyle that goes with heavy armaments, huh? That in and of itself can be bad, even if it has the desired consequences. And it's always a struggle between these two. And there's a need to be, a plug for my profession, to have very good social science analysis. But don't ever trust those rascals alone. Always raise the question of what is good and bad. And there's a need for clarification of logic, and the study of scriptures and inspiration of what is good. You got to put the two together, and it's complicated.
Yes.
Sometimes I get to the point where I'm convinced that the only unchristian thing is non-action in the areas of social issues. You know, this man's proposal here, you know, got that kind of response from this group. Both sides, well, neither side was wrong, you know, but I'm not so sure that everybody's going to say that any one of those sides was right. But many times we have decided, well, there is no way of coming to a real Christian position on an issue. Therefore, we will remain non-involved and just will not encounter the situation head-on. I think that's the unchristian thing. I feel that that was what Jesus did. Now, I beg to differ with you. You know that his judgment is going to be a little bit different from mine, although he will give me sometimes the insight to filter through and see maybe with his judgment what is right and wrong. I don't have that capacity, though, that he did. He was judgmental in a way that I'm not going to have the capacity for. But I feel that it's unchristian to remain uninvolved because I can't judge it.
Yeah, Joey?
Maybe along the same line, Mark. I guess one of the problems I have with people who do ethics is that there seems to be an assumption that we're all acting most of the time out of some kind of a free will and really consciously considering in the light of whatever our framework is, what is the good and what is not the good. And my experience tells me that I and most of the people I know most of the the time act all the time totally unconsciously. That we are socialized into what we do, that we're a part of a culture that tells us what to do, and that most of the time we are acting absolutely unconsciously. So I'm wondering whether there isn't even a prior question about the nature of Christian action, if there is such a thing, which mandates simply the heightening of self and social consciousness about acting, and that somehow the freedom under the gospel that we have as Christians is not freedom to act in any particular direction necessarily, but to make damn sure that we examine what it is we do. In the freedom that we have as agents marked with a plus sign. For me, the demon is not necessarily, you know, black folks used to tell me all the time in Chicago that they yearned to go back south where people were upfront conscious racists. They knew where they were coming from, they could deal with that. You get up to Chicago, everybody talks nice, it's a good game, but there are all these institutions that operate as if by some unseen hand, by momentum, that keep black folks in the same place they were in the South. Well, that's slipperier to deal with. People acting unconsciously as racists is harder than people acting consciously as racists. So I'm wondering whether the call really isn't simply to consciousness.
Yeah, I kind of resonate with that, because I guess I can't feel very comfortable about saying that some action is better than no action at all. There's just all kinds of examples of horrendous Christian action, which has been more demonic than anything else. And I think we just have operated without any sense of what really the consequences are going to be. There's another wrinkle to this that really bothers me, and that's what a lot of sociologists keep saying, that almost every objective that's sought out that is quote good, almost always turns out to do something else. In other words, the consequence really never quite follows what was intended. And, L.A., they set up a suicide line, and everybody that did this said, we're going to save a lot of 20 to 24-year-old male and females who have had problems in the love life or whatever, and this will be a very good thing. And, of course, what they found out was that 85% of the calls came from males who were 60 years or older. The intention was what happened was probably good, but it was certainly not in the light of the intention. And I just wonder if we don't, for the same reason that Jody mentioned, we really don't wrestle with enough of the consciousness of what is involved, that many times the good things that we think we are going to do turn out quite differently than...
If I remember correctly, question about your friend was, can I conclude therefore that he is not a Christian? Everybody said no. Can he conclude that I'm not a Christian? Everybody said no. Could we pose that a little differently? Can we ask the friend and ask this man, are you proposing that you get your stand regarding nuclear weaponry from your understanding of the ethics of Jesus, or your understanding of Scripture, or are you getting it more from something which is pragmatic, or are you getting it more from natural law? Can we not make a judgment on the background, the value system, and can you not then judge and say, you can say that, but you cannot really say that you came to that because you are a follower of the way in which the Scriptures understood that, or a disciple of Jesus. Can you? Wouldn't it phrase it a little bit differently on what you were judging? Because I'm not sure I would have said no very quickly to, can you say that you got that from Jesus, that the best way to have world peace is that everybody arm themselves? I don't think you can get that from Jesus.
May I respond? In that framework I put up is a way that I would try and handle it. I don't happen to know if this person is a Christian or not. Now, we can argue about the reality side, what is, will be. Hmm? history, logic, data, all that sort of stuff. We can also argue on the side of what is good and bad. And here, it seems to me, is where the fact that I realize that I'm a saved child of God makes a difference. And we can argue on that side. But I'm sorry, I have a position. I am a saved child of God. That's not arguable. And living in love is not arguable. We can't argue about the consequences on the reality side. Does that make any sense?
I'm not sure. I guess I'm just posing, and I'll pose it for people to respond to. The title or the question for today is there a Christian action? All right. Do we feel that there are actions faithful to Jesus Christ and other actions not faithful to Jesus Christ? Or actions which are faithful to following Jesus Christ as a disciple, other actions that are not faithful in following as a disciple of Jesus Christ? And I don't see any...
May I answer? Yes. The answer is yes. If you do not answer the question of what is good,
I can't
agree with that because of the people, the Christian action being taken in North Ireland. They both say what is happening is right. They both say it's good. They both say it's Christian action.
Well, right, but simply because people in fact disagree doesn't mean that there's no way of resolving the disagreement. I mean, people do in fact disagree all the time over what exactly is in keeping with Jesus's norm, okay? But the notion is that one can resolve those issues by attending more closely to what he said and did and so on. I think that's what you're getting at, right? Mm-hmm. I cut you off.
Oh, that's okay. I'm just thinking back again to the idea of arms and armament. During World War II, just from what I've read and heard, I get a very strong feeling that the church, by and large, approved, for instance, our entering into war with not only Germany, but Japan. Now, a lot of people on both sides were killed, but what would have happened if we had taken the position of non-response to Japan? And on the other hand, my father was imprisoned before I was born, but he was imprisoned because he did not believe that as a Christian, he would either serve or encourage others to serve in the armed forces. And so he distributed pamphlets, and he would have been, he was a few years before his time, but he would have been one of these who marched on Washington during Vietnam, encouraging people to dodge the draft and that sort of thing. He was doing this back in 1939, 1940. What position, what brought about the change in the church's position, or has there in fact been a change in the church's position regarding arms and war, or is that too far off the subject?
Well, if there are people who are interested in responding to that, it's fine. I think that we could take your question, and instead of asking the historical question, which asks all kinds of empirical questions, has the church changed, if so, how, which church, and why, which is a big, big question, if we could put what you posed, the experience of your father, and the sense, however among the majority, that indeed it was imperative, perhaps a Christian imperative, to vanquish Japan and Germany, and ask whether or not people here think, back in terms of John's question, that one of those courses, your father's non-cooperation and imprisonment, one could get from Jesus, while another one, moving to vanquish Japan and Germany, or if not to vanquish them, at least to get them to cease and desist their depredations, was not consonant with Jesus. Would that be fair to pose it that way? And just ask what people think. Do people think that one of those was in consonant with Jesus' teaching and another one was not? Oh, there it is.
Yeah, I think there's, in response to you, John, I think there's definitely things that are in accord with what Jesus would want us to do. I still think the difficulty is that we become arrogant when we have finally decided this is in fact what Jesus wants to do and we lose sight of so many things. I think what the Pharisees wanted to do with the, or how they felt about the prostitute was in fact correct. They had the right answer. Jesus never really said she is without sin, or she was not, she was doing something that was right. He didn't say that. He got after the Pharisees for being arrogant. Simple examples that I can see with families is parents complaining that their kids have no respect for law and order, and yet they consistently drive 75 miles an hour on the freeway. Just dumb kinds of things. Or a Christian community who has a style that says we're going to live in a certain way, but then we ostracize those that don't buy our way, or don't make them feel welcome. I think these are all the kind we need prophets. And we have a community who pronounce judgment on this and keep us struggling.
In love.
Well, if Christ admonished the Pharisees because of arrogance, and if Christ were here today, I think he would admonish me, being arrogant in my Christian walk. But as a church in the body of Christ, are we failing because we're not disciplining ourselves as the body of Christ enough? And the discipline isn't there as Christ was disciplining the people when he was here. So I'm posing a question now about discipline.
My father is a Christian, and he went into the war in World War II, and her father didn't. So that question, when you asked, nobody answered.
I know. People have a tendency to shy away from really.
Well, it's been difficult. I wanted to answer you, but I. Very much so. I don't know. He felt that was the Christian thing to do to protect his home. Now maybe that is wrong. And how can you tell?
I think it's the same question that you're talking about today in Ireland. It's not that easy to define. If you're dealing with the total Christian world, you'd have something. Christians are a minority in this world, not the majority by a long shot. If you take the situation of World War II, I certainly would not judge anybody who went to war as being non-Christian, or conversely, those that said they would not fight would automatically make them Christian. There are a number of responses that way that are very, very difficult to try to define as you look at the whole thing. I think you'd be hard pressed to look at Christ's response to any of his particular messages relative to carrying arms.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, in this world that we live in, would it have been totally Christian to have sat back peaceably during World War I and read the red Zeros fly over San Francisco and drop their bombs without any type of a retaliation? I think that would be pretty hard to defend also.
Okay, let's not try to escape from under the toughness of these issues by returning to an earlier consensus that we have. We all agree, I think, and if I'm misrepresenting someone by including this consensus, speak up, that a particular action we can't use and then make a judgment about the whole person. Say, well, he did that, he's not a Christian. Okay, that's not the question. The question is, we've got two strong alternative actions in the face of a situation, World War II. And we're asking about those actions. Okay? Are those Christian actions, and we mean by Christian, can they be done in such a and defended by an appeal to the word and witness of Christ? That's the question. We don't want to say, well, were these people Christian? Because I think we kind of agree that we feel bad, rightly, about making a kind of cosmic judgment about these people. Who are we to do that, number one? And in any case, is one action enough to make a person a Christian or non-Christian? Clearly no. Okay?
Now, one of the things, it is easier, I think, to make these judgments in a small community than in a large nation or the world. If my neighbor's house burns down, I think I know what I should do. But if hundreds of huts burn in India, or you move all the way up to the war thing, that's where it's harder, because it's much more difficult to predict the consequences. But I think I know what to do when things happen in my community. Now, as you get to a larger community, then it's harder. And it even gets harder when you're dealing with worlds. But that doesn't answer your question.
Well, notice that the value system to which you're appealing, and I mean, I think that your reminders of the connections between actions and consequences have been salutary, and I'm very pleased we have at least one social scientist and hope we have more with us. But notice that that appeals to a value system of evaluating actions in terms of real or imagined consequences. Now, that's not the only way to do ethics. That's one way to do it. There are other ways, some of which have surfaced. There are other value systems to which we can appeal, some of which we're born into and are unconscious of, and Jody's prescription is here very pertinent, that the first step might very well be to clarify our own value systems that may be very well unconscious, inarticulate, and we're unaware of, that come from our culture, our class, our history, and so on. But once those value systems are clarified, we hone in a little more heavily on exactly the content, again, of what it is that defines a Christian action, or what are Christian actions, and what are some that aren't, and what kind of appeal does one make to determine that, which is where we are in terms of these concrete choices. Anybody else? I don't know what's the custom in terms of getting the last word before lunch. It seems to be getting quarter till 12, and I don't know what the... Is it time for a last word, do you think? John, I don't know.
I think Holden, as I've understood it, I haven't been here that long, as I've understood it, we start when the bell rings, they go about an hour, the conversation continues if people want to, the dinner bell almost always ends it, no matter how good the conversation is, and people vote with their feet, meaning if they were counting on an hour, they've left by now, and that you're able to do that, probably we ought to end in 2 or 3 minutes so that when the bell rings, you don't have to run to make first set. So you ought to end by a quarter up. But they kind of drift on, and people drift in and out. Sorry.
Yes?
Well, I'm wondering, the two poles, you know, whether you fight in war or not fight in war, once war has been declared and is out, maybe there isn't a good or a bad. Maybe there you're starting to get into gray areas where you have two bad choices. I mean, either you help the enemy by not fighting, or you help your friends by fighting. In both cases, people are getting killed, and in both cases, it's evil. And so you sin, you finally have to decide what's the lesser of the evils. You sin boldly and believe more boldly still, and you don't have a Christian action. You have choices to be made that are both evil.
You're right, I think, in terms of the same value system that we just left. That is, if you're saying they're both bad or in some way deficient because they're both going to issue in terrible consequences, that is certainly a kind of value system that we work out of and talk through often and has been shared today. But supposing you're looking at the other end, either agent or motive, or perhaps Christ is norm, okay? Then there may be a different kind of answer by an appeal to that kind of ethics. It might be that one is at minimal better than another, and it may be at maximum that one is Christian and the other is not. The social scientist, I'm sorry, I don't know your name. What?
Jim Holder.
Jim, I'm sorry. Jim reminded us in his scheme here, and I think this is important, that we can't be, social scientists are not all that sure of a chain of consequences. And he reminded us, use the word irony. Oftentimes, the irony of our history is that we intend X, and move about to get X by doing Y, but we get Z instead, which happens to be the opposite of X. And we're fraught in our personal experience and historical community experience together with zillions of examples of this. Given that we can't control consequences, that we're often mistaken about them, that our life is shot through with ironies, it might be, though I'm putting this forward as a tentative hypothesis, more prudent and wiser to look at an ethic that does not so much base itself upon real or imagined consequences as it does look toward the norm of the person of Christ. That's looking in a different direction for what informs our action and makes it Christian or not. The others, your scheme, what was implicit in what you said about the fact that all the consequences when we're in war are somehow distressing, I think is quite accurate, and certainly has been my experience. The answer to it might be to reorient where we look in appraising what we do, rather than to the future, to the present and the past witness of Christ among us.